I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Well, we should say hello to everyone on Facebook, or however many of you are out there watching this. It's great to have you on board.
That sit on my Facebook. It's different.
Good to see you're in punchy form, Jonathan. We're here to talk about this evening, and obviously I have a vested interest as I was responsible for publishing it, but The Plagiarist in the Kitchen, which is, you say, your first and only cookbook.
Yeah.
And it's a cookbook, I think, that you could say is prosecuting unlike most cookbooks, which are there to entertain and inform, amuse, it actually has a philosophical kind of premise to it. And that premise is that all cooking, all recipe books are acts of theft, and that this is unique only in that it admits that it's a collection of culinary thefts. You own up to your your plagiarism, and indeed the title itself is an act of plagiarism.
Yeah, the title is an act of plagiarism. It was Julian Barnes wrote a book called The Pedant in the Kitchen, and when he found out I told him I was doing this, he said, "Well, what is it?" And I said, "Well, it's obviously a homage, Jules." And he said, "Well, that's fine." Yeah, it's there isn't anything new in the kitchen. I mean, if there is anything new, I don't know how many of you remember Mike Leigh's Life is Sweet with Timothy Spall as Aubrey, the chef of a restaurant unwisely titled The Regret Rien. anyone who has no regrets is obviously kind of insentient idiot. But Aubrey's idea of cooking, this was at the height of British Nouvelle Cuisine, with things like liver with jam. It's rarely gross stuff. This was admittedly before one started getting really silly things like foams and gels and
spiralized courgettes.
Yes, and I don't know what a spiralized courgette is, but it sounds like it fits into this particular.
I'd be unlikely to see it on your table anytime soon, Jonathan.
I wouldn't actually know what it is or how to do it, and I wouldn't want to do it. But I was interested in this idea of the fact that every cookbook is an act of theft. I mean, some of them are good acts of theft, but many aren't. The other thing I would hope about this is that it's written by someone who can read and write. That's myself. At the moment, there's a school, informal school of youngish architectural critics, Hatherley, Murphy, Wainwright, etc., who all write beautifully. And unlike my generation, or quite a lot of members of my generation, they don't all want to be in bed with Norman Foster and so on, and they're not a load of star fuckers. This has not happened with cookery writing. It's gone from bad to worse. It's the province of, and there are a few exceptions, evidently, but I mean, it does seem to be inhabited by kind of neo-post-literates. It's an interesting classification, but there you are.
That's good.
Who don't realise that the wheel has, you know, long since been invented, and there's, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. It's there. Everything that's added on, classic dishes with a twist. God Almighty! the entire world of entire foodie lexicon of artisan and craft and sauce. I'm going to source some beans. It means you go to the supermarket and you buy some beans. But and everything organic. I mean, I showed years ago, I did a film, series of food films in the early part of this century, and we showed how to organicize things, which is you just get some perfectly normal vegetables and you bathe them in mud. The fetishization of things like virgin olive oil and so on, extra virgin. How can you be an extra virgin? I mean, it's a quality which is probably useful if you're a nun, but otherwise incomprehensible. On the subject of nuns, I was in a restaurant in Exxon, but I don't really think about nuns unless they're very unsuitably dressed in
Valerian Borachek movie.
Yeah, Borachek. I mean, Franchi's good at that too.
Yeah.
In Aix-en-Provence, in a restaurant, there's a whole load of nuns tucking in. And the chief nun, I don't know what you've called a chief nun.
Mother Superior?
Appeared to be the late John Smith. much missed, the man who, had he lived, would have spared us Blair. But it was quite a remarkable resemblance. And so maybe he just thought, well, it's all too much. I'm going to go into hiding.
So there is a kind of a manifesto aspect to this book, isn't there? I mean, this is you know, you were 15 years restaurant critic for the Times, putting, as I think you said at the time, your mouth where other people's money was to go, and you're also famously you cook people who've tasted your home cooking have always said what an extraordinary cook you are. So these, in a way, this recipe is a sort of a riposte to the kind of the foodie brigade on one hand and the people who watch daytime television cookery shows on the other. It's kind of it's a pen in a way to sort of culinary classicism, isn't it? The idea that
it's also these various groups who you want to put the boot into. That's the important thing. Get your retaliation in first.
And you've done that by, in between each of the recipes in the book, there are reflections on plagiarism, and then it's kind of the idea of cook recipes being sort of, it's almost like a hall of mirrors, isn't it? One person steals from another, and even being able to find where the theft originally, the original act of theft is quite difficult to... And you taught this a wonderful phrase you use, cryptomnesia, which you say has a paramount role to play in the kitchen.
Yeah.
What's that?
It's the delusion that something that you have thought up is your own, rather than something which you've borrowed, which, I mean, and it happens if you write professionally, you kind of make notes and you look back and you don't know where the note has come from, but you kind of like that phrase and you use it. And someone will tell you, well, actually, that's not yours. It comes from X, Y, or Z. And I think that the same process is at work with lots of professional cooks. They think that they are the first person to have used cold risotto to make little overloids, which they've stuffed with something. And then you find that the people have been doing this in Sicily since the beginning of time and in Rome. It's forgivable, I think. But at the same time, one should probably check, I think.
I think there's only one original recipe in the book, and it ends with the phrase, chuck in bin. Do you want to tell us about the that? I'm just kind of curious that you decided to include it almost as a sort of a control test to show that originality is a bad idea at the best of times.
Yeah, I mean, the book is quite didactic in a way.
Unbelievably didactic.
I've never written anything.
Soufflés gain nothing from being made with flour. Okay. Yeah. Chipolata is a slurry in a kid's condom. I love.
Abattoir slurry.
On pot au feu. A crock of folklore and very bogus science is attached to this dish. Ignore. I mean, it's brilliant. It's full of, strong opinions, strongly expressed. Nothing, you say at one point, going back to your organic point, nothing is sustainable, which I think is a great...
No, sustainability is kind of one of the great shibboleths of the age, and it's clearly a load of balls. I mean, architects go on and on about being sustainable, but there is nothing less sustainable than making a building. It's wasteful of energy, it buggers up streets. London is like a kind of perpetual building site, and there's nothing sustainable about that. And they pull down buildings so quickly now. I mean, you know, stuff which was built in the 90s is now being pulled down. That is equally unsustainable, and I'm afraid, I mean, there are big announcements to make. None of us are sustainable. Not one of us is sustainable. We're all going to die. And it is preposterous, but it's not so surprising that it should come from food world and architecture world, which are both sort of they're both linguistically insentient.
You make a distinction early on, which is maybe an important one, the difference between art and craft. I think you stole that insight from...
I stole that from Gore Vidal.
Yeah, who probably stole it from someone else.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, but... You say that art may concern itself with expression, a quality that has no role in craft.
Yeah, quite. I mean, craft is useful for making rattan chairs and things.
But people who say they express themselves through their food are delusional. Or foaming, I think you say.
Well, they are. I mean, I think they're really crazy. But a lot of very, very stupid people in kitchens. I mean, you know, sort of... occasionally you'll get, you know, Rolly Lee and people like this who've actually, you know, can read and write and they're educated and bright and so on. But, I mean, the vast majority, I mean, used to come across these people and they petition you to write about their bloody awful restaurants.
But Rolly would probably agree with you, and I'm sure a lot of chefs, particularly chefs who've run great restaurants for a long time, that you say at one point, going back to zero... in order to reach a place which has been reached many times before, which is a sort of a... You could say that's almost... If you applied that in architecture, that would be a sort of classicism, wouldn't it? A kind of... That you're continually striving to recover something that has been done better in the past.
It'd probably be a cave.
Well, what's the culinary equivalent of a cave?
Well,
ham sandwich. There's a recipe for a ham sandwich in the book, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, why not? I mean, if it's proper ham sandwich, it's fine. I mean, I don't think...
You say a ham sandwich where the ham tastes of pig rather than... what was it? Yes, I think...
I can't remember.
Factory floor, industrial effort.
What was the question?
Well, it wasn't really a question, more a pointed observation. But one question I did want to ask you is that you're... having read this book in... shortly after I'd read your brilliant, I think, evocation of your childhood, sort of one of the best books about the 1950s ever published, an encyclopedia of myself, it's clear that your tastes in food were laid down early. Your mother was a good cook, and you travelled to France a lot as a child, and a lot of the cooking in this book is French cooking. And at some point, I think, in this book, you say that you taught yourself to cook through mastering the art of French cookery and practicing all those recipes. There was, I mean, that in terms of craft, you're not starting... It's not just going into a kitchen and making stuff up.
No, I followed that book very, very rigorously. And I, you know, I wouldn't leave out a step in any recipe. And once you've done that and you're kind of practicing, it's like doing scales or something. Or, you know, rendez-vous, or speaking properly. I mean, you need to learn to do these things before. You can't do any kind of art without craft, and I don't think you can do any. I don't think it makes cooking an art at all. I mean, I really don't think it is an art, but it's a craft. But it's a craft which has to be learned, and you can learn it in various ways. And I suspect that learning from a book is better than learning from kind of going to some cookery school. I don't know. I've never been to a cookery school. I mean, I don't despise them at all, but I think it's kind of a lazy thing to do if you could do it at home.
But you're interestingly quite. I mean, you know, you're not hidebound by the correct way of doing anything. I mean, like you say, you don't like extra virgin olive oil, and you say that you don't.
I don't dislike it. I think it's a waste of money, and it gives me a sore throat because it's so peppery.
But you're also, you say that cassoulet, which is one of those dishes which, you know, will arguments rage about what should or shouldn't be in a cassoulet and what the authentic cassoulet. You're not much interested in authenticity, are you?
No, I think, you know, if you want to get sort of authentic street food, I mean, you're going to get botulism, aren't you? There's nothing to be gained from authenticity. I mean, the French idea of this is quite interesting. The French colonial aspiration was to turn everyone in Mali and Algeria and God knows where else into a French man or woman, because they thought that the French thought that was the greatest thing you could be. Completely unlike the British aspirations for people in India and what became Pakistan. But the same process is in play with the French attitude to other people's cooking. They don't see any value in reproducing what is cooked in Taormina or something. They take the dish that's made in Taormina and they improve it and they try and make it French. I think that is very pertinent to any comparison between what you get in Britain and what you get in France. What's so good about being authentic? I mean, I don't understand why it's rated.
But you also, you have, there's a persistent theme in the book. You talk about Cecil Sharp and the English Folklore Society, and how it's a great passage where you say, basically, collecting these folk songs, he'd go into pubs in the West Country, and as soon as the guys knew that he was in collecting traditional songs and rewarding them with beer or a plug of baccy, they would just tell him, yeah, this is authentic. This has been sung in my family for generations. So the sort of the idea of an invented, authentic tradition is there in food as well.
Yes, it is. I mean, most famous writer about food of the past half century is Elizabeth David, and she wasn't really a cook. She was a writer. Collector. Yeah. It was a kind of folklorist, and wrote very well, which is why her books are still read today. But a lot of the recipes are approximate, to say the least. And there's one recipe which I put in there. I mean, it's a dish that I've made on a number of occasions called la sauce, or la sauce du vin de Médoc. And I asked a friend of mine who's got a restaurant in Bordeaux, La Tupina, which is my favourite restaurant in the world, whether he knew this
dish.
This
is the one you gave 11 out of 10.
Yeah. Whether he knew it. And he said, I've never heard of it. So he asked a friend of his who teaches the history of gastronomy at Bordeaux University whether he knew this dish. And said no such thing. And I think it's what happened was that someone heard that this English gentlewoman was collecting recipes and made it up and gave it to us. It's actually very, very good. But it's unknown in the Medoc. And so she was, in a way, gulled in the way that I suspect Cecil Sharp was, and Sabine Baring Gould, to whom we owe Uncle Tom Copley. And there were obviously other people who've done that sort of collecting, and people who collect knickknacks in the same way. But I mean that is a kind of false history, harmlessly false.
One of the things that you love, and you say that you love most the cooking of Alsace, is at one point you say it never changes, and that's why I love it. I just wondered, because you also say that English, you quite like being an English plagiarist, because there's a brilliant phrase, you say, the English have a shrugging indifference to their gastronomic heritage. And there aren't that many English recipes, although there is a sort of a German recipe for lobscouse, which is what you call the Scouser's beef dripping. At one point you call the Scouser's Madeleine. But
Better than the Madeleine. I mean,
but why Alsace?
It simply doesn't. It seems to have been impervious to all fashions in food. I don't know why. I mean, but that's certainly not the case in a lot of eastern and northeastern France. But in Alsace and Strasbourg and so on, Mutzig, it is always the same, and that which is what's so attractive about it.
You also say, I mean, going back to childhood, that you started cooking, there was a fashion for men cooking in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Which
came from Len Dayton.
Right. So cooking suddenly became cool and something that you were impressed.
Yeah, well, because Michael Caine did it in The Ypres File, you know, in sort of grinding his own coffee and that sort of thing, which, it seemed great when you're 17.
I mean, it sort of fell out of favour again. It's like maybe Jamie Oliver's revived that for a whole generation of men.
Who knows?
I didn't think you'd bite on that one. I thought we might go through some of the things that you strongly dislike, which some of which are surprising. You don't like herbs. You don't like basil at all.
I don't like herbs, no. I like spices.
Saffron in particular.
Saffron, I like Ras el Hanout, I like cumin, I like pimenton, Spanish piment, i.e. smoked paprika from Estremadura, not though from Murcia. well, there's a difference. I mean, in Murcia it's not smoked. And I I can't think what else I use, but I herbs I find they're a bully in many instances.
Basil in particular.
Yeah, but there's a lot of very nasty basil around, which doesn't have the kind of glossy leaves that one used to get, and the leaves now seem to be matte. And I don't know whether this genetic. I've got nothing against genetic modification, but I mean, I think that maybe this is. This is the result of such a process. I don't know.
You don't like fine dining, which you say is an anagram of tosser.
No, I mean, fine dining is dreadful. It's to do with it's like jargon. I mean, you know,
yeah.
Slang, as Jonathan Green will tell you, is the poetry of the gutter. Jargon is the prose of the executive estate. And I think it's people from executive estates who like fine dining. And I mean, I'd far sooner eat a McDonald's than go to a fine diner.
Yeah. Fine dining and Pim's another thing you don't like.
I hate Pim's. But that's to do with that kind of terminal Englishness where people wear striped blazers and women wear kind of hyper-frump outfits and everyone...
I mean,
pretends that they're kind of some aristo.
It's I mean, one of the attractive and lovely things. I mean, the book is not illustrated with sort of gastro porn pictures of food either, is it? They're abstract images that you have taken yourself, which have absolutely nothing to do with food in any.
No, way. I think. Well, the food photography has become rather cliched, and that's why I wanted to avoid it.
But it is a functioning cookbook, and I mean, one of the things that's...
Yes, it is fully functioning. Requires no prosthesis or anything. It doesn't limp around.
You've tested all the recipes.
I only included things which I've cooked myself at some stage in my life.
I had the ill-fated ham and fig tart.
The ham and fig tart was a tragedy because I thought, well, ham and fig, very good together. So I cooked them together, and it really didn't work out. And that was the one which got chucked in the bin.
Which you included, as I say, for it. But what about, if you're stood in front of your fridge, Jonathan, and you've got a set of ingredients, and you can't be asked going and buying new ones, and you make something out of the ingredients in your fridge, out of the leftovers, isn't that not bordering on the edge of being original, creative?
I don't look at it that way.
You've never had that happy moment where you put two things together and you think, actually, that works rather brilliantly. I hadn't thought of that before.
I don't know, maybe. Obviously, the book is absolutely mendacious, so...
I like that. So it's a lie within a lie. That's even better.
Yeah,
brilliant.
But I mean, there is a,
and also there's a brilliant passage where something is described as homemade, and you say, why is that a positive thing? Have you seen most people's homes?
Yeah.
What's wrong with proper biscuits that are made in a factory, like Carr's water biscuits or
Nairn's oat cakes? This sort of cult of home baking, home this, home that, seems ridiculous when at last in Britain one has got very good bakers, not just in London, but all over the place.
You're also disinclined, you say, to try, about ethnic recipes. It's futile to steal what you can't understand. So you say you don't really try and cook Chinese or Indian or...
No, I was brought up eating an awful lot of Indian food because my father had been in India during the war and had lots of spices, which he'd had put into boxes which had been soldered so to keep them fresh. And that, we're still eating those kind of 15 years after the end of the war. I haven't been to an Indian restaurant for about 12 years now. Rarely interested me that much.
You quite like a bit of Middle Eastern food, though, don't you?
I like Middle Eastern food, and I like North African food.
But you don't usually make it, is that what you're...
No, I don't make it.
If the other fella can do it better, let him.
Yes, yeah. And Chinese food, which I adore, but I mean, I adore some. I would never dream of trying to cook it any more than I'd start writing an ideograms.
Although, yeah, it's an interesting thought. Maybe if we sell the Chinese rights to this book, I can fulfil that dream for you.
Right.
I was thinking, one of the things you do say, which I guess the Elizabeth David discussion, is to steal from the best. And there's a brilliant shepherd's pie recipe here that you lifted from Anthony Burgess.
No, I didn't know. It's Lancashire hot pot. Yeah, but that's word for word. But I asked him. At least I asked his. I asked the foundation if it was okay.
And they were fine with that.
They're fine with it, and his shade is very happy.
the other, which is again a recipe which I haven't tried, but I'm planning to, is the gigot à la clinique. which is from the Alice Toklas
cookbook. Yeah, that's stolen, but I couldn't reproduce that word for word because someone stole my Alice B. Toklas cookbook. So I had to do it from memory, but it's a fantastic recipe for anyone who can get a hold of a veterinary syringe.
Do you think that this it does have a veterinary? I have to say, mostly in the book, you don't. This book is within the reach in terms of ingredients and equipment of the most people's kitchens.
Well, I mean, the thing about ingredients, I mean, it's quite an important point, is that the fewer ingredients, the better. I have a kind of loathing. I mean, the three most depressing words in the English language, according to Kingsley Amis, were red or white. I asked a friend of mine what he thought were three most depressing words, and he said, new comedy series. mine are all the trimmings. Which I like to get one thing on a plate. I mean, in Italy, if you ask for a steak, you get a steak, and you don't get garnish, which belongs actually to the world of fine dining. You don't get squiggles of some unidentified kind of liquid which have come out of a squeezy bottle, making a little pattern. You just get one thing, and I find this far more satisfying than the sort of overladen dish which still persists to this day in Britain.
Given that you spent so much time eating in restaurants, I mean, you when you finished doing that, do you still eat out as much as you did and
no,
with as much pleasure?
No, it was a job. I mean, I got paid for doing it. And it became an increasingly tiresome job. Especially as I kept on getting directed to, you know,
Aberystwyth.
Aberystwyth and Gannets really was something else. And on the way to the loo from the dining room, there was this bucket of kind of opaque, brownish liquid, which I think in Pantone, the shade is called Baby's First Try. And this gunk was put over every dish. It was quite the most horrible place I've ever been in my life. But to my astonishment, I looked up a few years ago and it was still going. Which suggests something about the taste of the Welsh. But I mean, you know, Wales is a country the size of Belgium and hasn't invented its own alcoholic drink, whereas Belgium has sort of 800 different beers and God knows how many different kinds of gin. That's to do with, obviously, Chapel and malarkey.
I think that you've written about the implausible books. I think the John Knox cookbook, sort of 1,000 Ways with a Parsnip.
Yes.
That there was a terrible, I mean, that there was a kind of a break in the in what you might call traditional peasant cooking in this country that was occasioned by a combination of Protestantism and the Industrial Revolution. But that doesn't seem to have affected the cooking of a lot of Northern Europe. Your amazing and Magnetic North series, I mean, one of the great joys of that is the occasional forays into the cooking of those places.
Well, it was originally going to be called Herrings and Schnapps, but some bright spark at the BBC couldn't understand what that meant.
Although herrings, I think Alan Davidson said that in order to be of marriageable quality, you had to have at least a woman had to have at least 100 ways of preparing a herring in Denmark.
Oh, quite probably, yes. but the industrialisation of Britain happened much earlier than that of Germany and so on. And it happened in cities. I mean, in France, you'd be driving through countryside and you come across the steelworks. I mean, early steelworks or early forge or something like that, rather in the way that in Derbyshire. But otherwise, you've got these kind of concentrations. And so people kind of left the land. It wasn't that they left the land and went to the cities and lost the and stuff that was passed down. That didn't happen because of the kind of the demographic shape of the Industrial Revolution elsewhere.
Do you feel, I mean, that, again, you say at various points that there's a sort of an advantage in being English in that you don't have a tradition, a clear tradition, that it's easier. English food is always borrowed and stolen and kind of improvised. And do you think that means a lot of people you will hear now say that London's the best place for food in the world, which it's difficult to...
Well, I think that they've been saying that for a long time.
The gastronomic revolution.
The gastronomic revolution and so on. I mean, I think the thing is that I don't know. I'm not in London often enough to be able to assess that. But what I would say is that the part of the culinary world which was most expertly done during the time that I took a professional interest in it, was PR. The PRs were much better at their job and in convincing everyone that how good cooking was in Britain than a lot of the chefs who they represented. This is a broadly English trait that that lies are believed. That there's not enough questioning and
scrutiny
and bloody-minded cynicism.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of bloody-minded cynicism in this cookbook. But you say it's going to be your only cookbook. You feel that the best. You've given your all.
Yeah. I've done it. I've retired. I might become a manager now. Or a philosopher like Joey Barton.
Yeah, well, the book is studied through with philosophy. I mean, there are even some heartwarming stories. I was amazed to read about because I know you as a man who loves to eat hair, but there's the very very diverting story of Levi in the book, which perhaps you ought to tell, just to show that there is a there is a warm.
Yeah, my caring side. No, at a place that we were living in France, in the country, we had a hare who used to...
it's a good recipe, by the way.
But I say at the end of the recipe for hare, which is the only good recipe I know, which is effectively for lièvre à la voyelle or jugged hare or whatever you call it. I mean, it's all more or less the same. It's, you cook it for a very long time. And I say, because of this... hare who used to come and sunbathe and was sheltered from the chasse. I mean, wherever you are in France at weekends, there are thousands of gung-ho maniacs wearing high-vis clothes shooting at anything, mostly shooting at themselves, but at each other, rather. But the hare we became very fond of and gave it a name, Levi, from Levi the Leveret. And I've never eaten hare since, and I don't think I could bear to, but I give the recipe, and I say, you serve it with buttered noodles and gilt.
You don't show any such... there's a brilliant recipe for spatchcock chicken where you say, don't hold back. Rough love is perfectly all right when you're crushing a chicken because it's dead.
But I mean... That's
a dead chicken, right?
Yeah, an extraordinary thing by what's he called? Anthony Bourdain, celebrated chef, who writes about some other chef and how he fondles a fish. And it's like, you think, Christ, this is like sort of some Jimmy Savile of the deep. very, very worrying. That was in Stephen Poole's great book, You Aren't What You Eat.
Yeah, I mean, which is a brilliant kind of dissection of foodie culture. I mean, it seems to me in the book you've got good ingredients, and treat the ingredients with respect. Recipes are blueprints rather than kind of. It's common sense in a lot of ways, isn't it? That your approach to food.
Yes, I mean the thing is that it is problematic in England in that much English produce is much inferior to what is the norm in the southern half of France, well, most of France, Italy, and so on. I mean, vegetables and
fruit in particular.
Fruit tastes of something other than water. I mean, the Dutch have an awful lot to answer for growing things hydroponically. Produce in general is better elsewhere, and it's also not nearly so expensive. And you don't need to play around with it and gussy it up in the way that is always going to be a temptation to anyone cooking in Britain, because you need to make it taste of something.
And I sort of get the feeling you're not a man for the menu de dégustation, the sort of the 20 course kind of.
No, that is again something to do with fine dining and Michelin stars, which are kind of strike me as being kind of, a place has got 3 Michelin stars, it's worth avoiding. Really, I'm serious.
I know.
You've been to Lameloise, my God.
But you still eat out in Marseille?
Yeah, but not in the flash places. I mean, the flash places all sell bouillabaisse. And there's a bouillabaisse charter, which, is sort of medieval writing on a bit of leatherette, which I think is extremely dodgy. But bouillabaisse is an old Provençal word, which means we saw you coming. and there are many good restaurants which don't do that, and which serve excellent and fairly simple, well, very simple cooking, but expertly done. I mean, the plainer it is, the better. But that doesn't mean to say that it's like, good plain cooking in the English sense. There's no excess. I mean, it's just the it's like the Italian thing. I mean, it's a very Italian city.
A lot of the recipes, it seems to me too, in the book, which you do is you borrow or steal a recipe, and then you'll do one thing slightly differently because you prefer it that way, which is gives you the sort of the sense of that you've made a little inflection. Like you steal the meatball, Mrs. Scorsese's mum's meatball recipe from Goodfellas that she writes about, and you don't put in oregano or oregano because she recommends that it makes it repeat on you, and you don't like herbs anyway, That's fine. But she says, on no account fry the meatballs, but you, on every account, do fry the meatballs.
I do, yeah.
Because you like the taste, presumably.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to offend any member of the Goodfellas clan. I mean, obviously. especially not Joe Pesci. Yes, I think it's better if you do fry them first. But, I mean, if you go to a really good, Italian-American restaurant like Wobbero's in the North Bronx, I think I got the feeling they kind of fry their meatballs, but I don't know.
It's interesting when you say that about great restaurants. You make the point in the book that great restaurants, often their menus, they don't have a problem with originality. Often their menus don't, a lot of the great institutions, their menus don't change all the time.
No, they don't change, and I think the more intelligent a chef, the more realizes that, as Paul Bocuse said, I mean, he really is a great chef, and a chef is lucky to create one dish in his lifetime. Bocuse perceives of being a chef as someone who's passing on the baton, who's taking what is already there and playing around with it a bit, but doing essentially just trying to make it better, which usually means kind of losing half a dozen ingredients which have been appended to it down the years.
Trimmings, yeah.
Well, not necessarily the trimmings, but the sheer number of herbs which are cancelling each other out, and that sort of thing.
Again, one of your more de haut en bas pronouncements about risotto is that wine adds nothing.
Well, in my opinion, it doesn't. I mean, I don't get it. What it's supposed to do, because it's not like making say a beurre blanc, where it's absolutely essential. I mean, it's just lost.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of wine which is worth losing.
But it's a brilliant the risotto recipes worth. I mean, there's a lot of things that you shouldn't do, like go and have a fag halfway through. And...
Well, that applies to cooking in general. I mean, you don't go, out onto the street with the snout cast. stick to your last, mate.
Yeah, and don't serve it with lots of horrible garnish. What was the last good meal that you ate in London, and where was it?
Ate quite nice.
Honey and smoke.
Yeah, that was good.
Pigeon.
Good.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I mean, it was nothing extraordinary, but it was quite pleasant.
And you're not, I've never seen you in a restaurant scribble down a recipe, think, "Oh, this is good, I must do this at home." Do you sort of feel you have everything? Your as it were, your repertoire is mostly in that in between that. I mean, it's not a fat book, but it's full of goodness.
Like a pig.
nothing wrong with a pig.
Nothing wrong with a pig. John keeps pigs, by the way.
I do.
And
I remember.
So one of these events I was actually talking about Snow Wilson and Dusty Hughes's Pig Night. Very fine screenplay from Snow's play, which they were aggrieved not to get a grant for, because the first shot is of a man. And a pig at it together. And Snow was particularly miffed at this because he said, "Well, it's in East Anglia, for God's sake."
Maybe we should open it up for a few more questions if people are.
Thank you both so much. If you have questions, strong opinions, strongly expressed, of course. That's on the recipe.
Feel free to disagree. It's a book that begs for disagreement and wrangling of all kinds. But it is very cookable. I'd have to say the recipes, home tested, work very well.
Thank you, gentlemen. Yeah, the middle there.
Yeah, I was interested in the analogy between dance and cooking, and how that might work as a. Quite well, and I was just wondering if you could sort of say more about that.
I would if I could hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I was interested in the analogy between dance, kind of folk dance and cookery, and I just thought that something that one could go with further, and was interested in your thoughts on it.
Well, in the sense of getting things being passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah, it seems to me something that's quite evanescent, that it doesn't last. It just happens in the moment. And the idea that there are traditional forms, and then there are forms where things are kind of put together in a kind of international stealing from different sources, which are kind of have a lineage somewhere, that are kind of cultural expressions.
I don't get what that's got to do with folk dance. I mean, incest and folk dancing, as Arnold Bax said, those are the two things to avoid. I don't know anything about folk dancing, so I have no opinion on whether there's a kinship between cooking and folk dancing. I'm always rather horrified by Morris dancing. I don't know why.
Yeah, I'm thinking of, say, something like the tango, which is...
I see. Yeah. I wouldn't call that...
So, which has a kind of very traditional root and belongs to a particular place, and then maybe how it's danced around the world is something quite... It has mixed in different bits and pieces from ballroom or from other sources.
I've seen tango and rather enjoyed... Sort of tango class on the steps of Clermont-Ferrand Cathedral once, which was rather beautiful. But I don't know whether dance spreads in the same way as food. I mean, anything which is not dependent on a language will you know, spread. I mean, you get the same buildings all over the world now. I mean, you know, London is looking increasingly like some Midwestern city.
And probably eating Midwestern food. I mean, you know, barbecue restaurants much more likely to be springing up than a fine dining French restaurant now.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any more thoughts, comments, gentlemen? Here looks like you're very keen to see.
Yeah.
That's all right. Don't need the microphone.
And if you wouldn't mind for
everyone
else.
Thank you. Sorry. Thanks so much.
Hello. John, did you like Keith Floyd? Because a lot of what you're saying sounds like Keith's philosophy.
Keith Floyd?
Yeah, I keep it simple.
Prefer no. Keith Floyd to Pink Floyd. yeah, because I mean, Keith was not pompous. He didn't do 25-hour guitar solos. I liked Keith. He was a good thing.
He's one of a very small number of TV chefs that you do like, though, isn't he? Let's be honest.
Yeah, he's the best, without a doubt. I spent a week with him in Manchester once and was greeted every morning about 9 o'clock saying, you know, let's go and have a dram. And I said, no, because we're doing a shameful TV programme together. and I'd say, well, it's 6 o'clock when we wrap. And Keith would then go and find a member of the staff to drink with, because he was convinced if he drank with someone else, he didn't have a drink problem. It was rather distressing, because he was hauling kind of junior members of the front desk to the bar, and it had to be explained to the manager that this was, you know, Mr. Floyd, and this is how he behaved.
Method acting,
but I miss him. He was very, very good on TV, but there's nothing to do with him being a good chef. He had that sort of particular charm of kind of small-town Lothario, which works very well. Worked on me.
Thank you. Any more thoughts, comments, recipe suggestions?
Have you got a favourite in the book, Jonathan? That you, your signature dish. What's your signature dish?
I've given up that lark. No, I mean,
you have cooked. You weren't you on Celebrity MasterChef at one point?
No. No.
Definitely, were on one of those TV shows.
No, I was asked to be a judge on one of them.
That's
once.
Right. Yeah.
And I the person who I judged to be the best was the simplest, the least fancy. But that's my only experience of that. I mean, I did make this, you know, do these three films about the state of British cooking.
They're not in the season
because they're completely, you know.
They're on.
There'll be some
of them are on the DVD, and
they'll
others,
be on YouTube
and
somewhere.
YouTube, yeah. For Vimeo now, Mead Shrine. Should you want to, I think a lot of Jonathan's films, you have to watch them in 3 bits. But it's...
no, you don't. Not on Vimeo,
don't you?
No.
You don't have to watch them in 3 bits. But it's Mead Shrine. It's where whoever does it, we don't know who does it.
Well, I thought you found him.
Well, we found him, but we don't know who he is. We talk to him, but he doesn't. Well, it might be a she.
No, I think it's probably someone who works at the BBC who's doing it. It's kind of
on the sly.
On the sly.
Yeah, because the quality is very, very good.
Yeah.
It doesn't have that sort of filmed on my camcorder at home.
No, not at all. No.
Sorry, there was another question.
You've talked about French food. I just wondered what you thought about Italian food versus French food.
Well,
like if there's
which Italian food?
Or okay, well, which area of Europe would be your favorite food?
I like there are all sorts of things I like. I like specific things in different places. I like Labskaus in northern Germany. which is where Scousers come from. I don't mean they come from there; they actually come from Ireland, don't they? I like one of the more recent things that I'd had, which I included in this, was a dish called frico, which comes from Trieste and around there, and is kind of very sort of gastronomically incorrect because it's just lots of potatoes and cheese. I mean, it's like a bit like tartiflette or something, but much better. And I like the cooking of Northern Italy. The further down you get, with the exception of the Jewish quarter of Rome, I'm not so keen on. But there are all sorts of places. I mean, I hate the fine dining restaurants in San Sebastian, but I like the bars where one bar will serve just mushrooms and another will do just ham. I mean, those places are great. Whereas the fine dining places are pretentious and ludicrously overpriced and, how much fawning can one take?
There's a great recipe in the book for migas, which you...
Yeah,
kind of from the Buñuel film just done, which you just invented that to on the basis of what you could see on the screen.
Well, on the screen, I mean, Catherine Deneuve and the guy who plays the bell ringer are eating tiny croutons about the size of a small fingernail, and it's just the kind of greatest gastronomic thing in all cinema. I mean, it's wonderful. But that's Buñuel. I mean,
it's a good recipe. That's one I've made. It's very good.
Do we have one more?
How concerned are you with the ambience, the nature of places you eat in? I mean, what I'm saying, I suppose, would you enjoy a reasonable meal in a place that you felt happy to be in or content to be in, rather than a better meal in an ambience or an environment that you didn't like? I mean, with your concern for buildings and interiors and...
I don't like noise, which there's an awful lot of. But I don't particularly like some hugely over-designed spaces, but I'm fairly Catholic in that matter. I used to like La Coupole very much, but just because it's such a fantastic, great barn of a place. But the last time I went there, no one has sort of come to service after 40 minutes, so he just walked out. It doesn't really bother me. I mean, I probably used to write about it quite a lot because there was generally very little to say about anything else. But now I'm back in Civvy Street and don't have to kind of slog around restaurants. That sounds ungrateful. It's a very nice job to have for a time. I mean, it becomes tiresome. I'd sooner go somewhere where you get something good to eat than somewhere which is shouting out to kind of be interesting and
do you worry that there is this sort of gastronomic monoculture that's kind of everywhere now, that sort of places in London, places in New York, even places in Europe, sort of kind of Soho House sort of style of brasserie, kind of apparently innovative cooking. But I mean, does that worry you? I mean, it seems to me that you like to eat the food that is local to the place that you're in. If that has a good gastronomic tradition, the food will be good. If it doesn't, it won't be. Aberystwyth, not so much.
I can't.
Lyon.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of the bouchons in Lyon are really sort of grubby. I mean, they look like sort of, the Quentin Crisp school of leave dust there for long enough and you forget it's there. and I like those places. But I don't know why I should be worried about restaurant design. I mean, I don't have to think about it any longer, thank God. And yes, they are. There is a kind of homogeneity which is apparent even. I don't think it's hitting France as well, or Paris.
But not so much down your way.
No. It's pretty impervious to fashion, I must say.
Excellent. Well, do you think that's a kind of a good moment at which to leave it? Thank you for sharing. I mean, obviously, I'm going to say, do read the cookbook. Buy it if you don't have a copy. Buy two copies and give one to a close friend who likes to cook. But,
or more.
Or more. Yeah, buy a whole... There's plenty of them here. We've got a warehouse full of them. It has been remarkably well reviewed, and it is selling well, I'm pleased to say, and so it should. It's the most original cookbook I've read in many a year, and it is both, as I say, it's a book to argue with, but also a book to cook from. So thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.